Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington. Ahead, an analyst considers North Korea's response to military exercises, remembering the life of former First Lady Nancy Reagan. We speak with the author of a book on what a U.S. presidential nominee needs.
We really have to have a president who can attract that brain trust to deal with these gigantic issues.
And an American organization is empowering African girls. It's right here on The Voice of America. As South Korean and U.S. military forces embarked on annual military exercises, North Korea today threatened to launch an indiscriminate, preemptive nuclear strike, insisting the exercises are a prelude to conflict. The U.N. Security Council has unanimously adopted the toughest sanctions yet against Pyongyang, including mandatory inspections of all cargo going into and out of North Korea, and a ban on exports of mineral resources, a major source of hard currency. Pyongyang conducted a fourth nuclear test January 6, followed in February by a long-range rocket launch, actions banned by previous resolutions. Troy Stangeron of the Washington-based Korea Economic Institute tells VOA's Victor Beatty this is a typical North Korean response to the joint exercises.
Every year during the period of the exercises, they take and one, ask that they not take place, and then two, engage in different threats. In terms of the specific threats we've seen from North Korea, we've seen a change since Kim Jong-un has come to power. The threats have become more specific and more common. We did a study back in 2013 during the last crisis to look at how things had changed under Kim Jong-un. And, for example, we found that in KCNA, their primary news outlet, references to war were up over 100% compared to the second nuclear crisis, and this was before we had entered into the new crisis under Kim Jong-un. We've seen the significant ramping up. In 2013, North Korea had threatened to take and nuke Tokyo. They had also released a photo with ICBM tracks on it that indicated targets in the United States as well. So we've seen this continuously from the North Koreans.
Is the North capable of carrying out such threats?
In terms of attacking the U.S., I would say no. We've seen the satellite launch, and they've proven they can take and put an object in orbit. But reentry is the most difficult part, in terms of both developing the proper guidance to actually hit a target and then also the heat shielding. They've not demonstrated they can actually achieve that process. For the purposes of planning, military personnel need to assume they can, but I think it's unlikely that they could attack a U.S. target. In terms of carrying out a threat on, say, Tokyo or perhaps Guam, they do have shorter range missiles, which we do know are capable. The question becomes, have they miniaturized the warhead small enough to take and place it on one of those missiles? I think at this point, potentially, but we don't know for sure.
The North has to know that if they launch such a strike, it would probably mean the end of the North Korean regime.
That's true. If the North were to take and attack either Tokyo, U.S. bases in Guam, or the South, it would mean the end for the regime. Most likely, this has to do with its own internal politics, with the transition to Kim Jong-un still taking place, with the U.N. sanctions having occurred. He needs to show strength internally to both people in the military and the broader populace. This is largely also probably for domestic consumption as well.
Why were the U.S. and South Korean military exercises combined and moved to an earlier date?
I think this is in response to the provocation from North Korea with the missile tests and nuclear tests. The United States and South Korea are trying to send a signal to the North that we have firm resolve that should they attempt anything, that we will respond and that they should be certain in that response.
The combined Full Eagle and Key Resolve exercises over the next 2 months will involve over 300,000 South Korean and U.S. troops backed by naval and air assets. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Scientists have found evidence of the rare element curium in a carbon-rich meteorite. This radioactive element is not known to occur naturally on Earth, but instead is manufactured or is produced as the side effect of a nuclear explosion. Curium wasn't discovered until 1944, when Glenn Seaborg and his colleagues at the University of California, Berkeley, created the element after bombarding the atoms of plutonium with alpha particles. The researchers who detail their discovery in the journal actual science advances suggest that the curium wound up in the meteorite during the formation of the solar system after a gaseous cloud that went on to create the sun condensed. The researchers say that they believe that finding this rare material in a meteorite may cause scientists to reconsider current models of stellar evolution and nucleosynthesis, which is a change in the chemical composition of a star. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Former First Lady Nancy Reagan, the steadfast partner of the 40th U.S. President Ronald Reagan, died Sunday of congestive heart failure. She was 94 years old. She will be buried beside her husband at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley, California. Touching tributes have been pouring in for the former First Lady. The executive director of the Reagan Foundation, John Heibusch, spoke about his reaction to the passing of Nancy with my colleague, Michael Lippin.
No doubt everyone here is about as sad as it gets. We worked very, very closely with Mrs. Reagan for many years, and she was our leader and our inspiration. So to have lost her overnight as we did, it's a terrible thing. And something that we just have to live with, but we've also planned for, and so now we need to move on and have her buried next to President Reagan, as was the plan, and then move on with the work of the President's Foundation.
How did you get to know Nancy Reagan yourself?
Well, I certainly knew her from afar when I worked on Capitol Hill during the Reagan administration, and I had met her on a couple of occasions, just in passing sort of meetings during his presidency. But then Mrs. Reagan called me when they were searching for someone to run the Reagan Foundation and Library about 6 years ago. And I had a great talk with her over the phone and then interviewed with her directly. And so ever since then, it's history. I spent a lot of time working very closely with her. She's on our board of trustees, and had a great deal to say with how the foundation and library was run.
Well, how active was she in her final years with the foundation?
Yeah, very active. I'd say in the past year, her activity trailed off somewhat as her health began to fail her. But up until the very end, she was with us 110% mentally. She had all her mental faculties about her. So behind the scenes, for the last several years, she's attended all of the foundation's board meetings and been very much a part of our decision-making process for important matters. So she's been very involved.
Well, looking back at her time as First Lady in the 1980s, what would you say about the influence she had during the presidency of Ronald Reagan?
I don't think President Reagan could have succeeded as much as he did without having this incredibly strong and supportive pillar, standing by him at every moment of the day. They just had such an incredibly close relationship, and I think the president would have been a bit adrift if Nancy had not been part of his life so much so. And as a result, I think the nation owes her somewhat of a debt of gratitude for being there for him and for being his strong right arm, and also for being the one that took care of him at his bedside for 10 years when he had to succumb to Alzheimer's. That was a really, really difficult assignment, but something she took on with great love and great compassion.
Our social media reporter G. Abby Lee is in the studio to tell us what people are saying about the passing of former First Lady Nancy Reagan. Hi, G.
Hi, Susan.
How is this story being tweeted on Twitter?
It's getting a lot of traffic, especially because Twitter featured it in the Moments section. Moments is a relatively new tool on Twitter, and it's like a gallery of curated tweets on a topic. The first tweet on the Moments page is one by White House photographer Pete Souza, at Pete Souza, that's S-O-U-Z-A. He wrote, "Rest in peace, Nancy Reagan. A couple of photos from when I was official White House photographer for President Reagan." And he shared two photos of the couple hugging each other, one at a ranch, and another one in which President Reagan is dressed as Santa Claus with his wife on his lap. More than 2,000 people liked that tweet.
Isn't he still the White House photographer?
He is. He worked with President Reagan from 1983 through 1989, and has been working with President Obama since 2009.
Well, what are some reactions from the presidential contenders?
Everyone still in the running tweeted about her passing away. On the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton tweeted, "Nancy's advocacy work for Alzheimer's research was tireless, and as you know, her husband was diagnosed with that disease in 1994. Bernie Sanders wrote, "This is a sad day for America and that she will be dearly missed." On the GOP side, Donald Trump tweeted, "She was the wife of a truly great president," and Marco Rubio wrote, "She was a true example of integrity and grace." Ted Cruz tweeted she had a deep passion for this nation. John Kasich actually just shared a link to a statement with a tweet reading, "Ohio Governor John Kasich's statement on the passing of Nancy Reagan." Quite dry, but not any drier than his other tweets. Speaking of the presidential race, Cruz won 48.2% of the Republican vote, and Sanders won 67.7% of the Democratic vote. Now, this was an especially important win for Sanders because Kansas voters picked the Democratic Party's nominee for the last 50 years. That's all for me today.
Thanks for the Twitter wrap-up, G. She's on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. The United States is in the thick of the process of selecting candidates for president in the two main political parties, the Republicans and the Democrats. But how does a voter choose? Here to give us some tips is Loyola University professor Emilio Iodice, who is author of 2016 Selecting the President, the Most Important Decision You Will Ever Make. And he joins us on the line from Rome. Welcome, Emilio.
Thank you very much, Susan, and thank you for the invitation to talk about the book and also the process that each of us as Americans have to go through to really vote for the only planetary leader. And that's what I say in my book, that the President of the United States is the only real planetary leader, and that's why our vote is so important. And the book focuses on those leadership traits that a president must have today. And I use examples from history, from a number of different presidents, to come up with 15 major traits that we find that are absolutely essential for the commander-in-chief. None of our presidents have really had all 15, but our greatest presidents have had the ability, number one, for instance, to be a reformer. They've had courage. They've had character, the ability to convey a message, a vision. They've also had emotional intelligence. These are among the most important qualities in addition to relevant experience. And I go into this in great depth in the book.
Well, this is a very important time to choose the best candidate for the White House because the world is in such turmoil right now, especially the Middle East, places in Africa.
Well, that's where I begin with the book. I lay out the great issues that the next president will face. And I begin by explaining that a president, of course, doesn't govern alone. They have to bring in a brain trust, the best and the brightest, in order to deal with these lethal problems that we're facing all over the globe, whether it's international terrorism, whether it's epidemics that are still with us, whether it's the economic problems that we're facing both in the United States and around the globe. These are all very, very serious issues, and they require the best talent, the best minds to come in. So we really have to have a president who can attract that brain trust to deal with these gigantic issues. Each and every one of them by themselves, like the environment, requires international cooperation. It requires communication. It requires a great deal of study and engagement around the globe. And the United States has to really have a commander-in-chief that knows how to do that.
You need somebody with diplomacy skills.
Diplomacy is very, very important. And where you get that, it could be from either the State Department, where I come from originally, from the field of diplomacy, or it could be even in the private sector. There's some diplomacy involved there and, of course, international business. But it requires really understanding where the ball is going to bounce as far as these great international issues.
You know, you have these points that we should keep in mind as we're choosing a candidate, but can we really judge these candidates by what they say and how they present themselves? I mean, do we ever really know what they're like?
Well, one of the things that we've learned from history, and again, I explain this in the book, that their background does have a relationship to what they do in the future. It really does. So the way they've performed and acted in the past really is a way that they will also act in the future. We see it, for instance, with Franklin Roosevelt as governor of New York. In the time that he was there, he started dealing already with the Great Depression, with the unemployment problems that were facing the state. And we can see it with every single administration where their background does have an echo of what's up ahead. It teaches them how to separate noises from signals, and that's what we need to understand. Can they separate the great noises from the signals?
And the name of your book again?
2016, Selecting the President, the Most Important Decision You Will Ever Make, and it's on Amazon.com.
Well, thank you very much, Professor, for your time.
Thank you, Susan.
This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
As the world gets ready to recognize the achievements of women on International Women's Day, March 8th, VOA's Julie Tabo in Washington and reporter Jill Craig in Kenya shine a spotlight on a U.S.-based organization that is helping empower young Maasai girls and women in Kenya through education, one life at a time.
Gloria Kotente Mometa is training to be a doctor.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
As a medical student from Kenya, she's learned a great deal in the 8 weeks she's spent in hospitals in and around Washington.
So this is the right kidney?
Mm-hmm. And she hopes to share that newfound knowledge with her peers back home.
My experience here has been great. The doctors are great. I've got to do a lot of things which I wouldn't have done in my country. I've learned how to use an ultrasound. Scan patients. That is a program we don't have in my school, and that's a program I would love to start in the future.
There's a ventilator in the back.
Seeing a young woman receive medical training is not an unusual sight in a large hospital like this, except Gloria is a Maasai. An ethnic patriarchal tribe in Kenya and northern Tanzania, in which less than half of all girls attend primary school, and only 1% go to college.
A Maasai girl doing medicine in my country is a big deal. And most of the time I get that question, you are Maasai and you're in med school, how did you get here? It's been a great journey for me.
Will you stick that?
No.
Gloria's journey began when she learned about the Maasai Girls Education Fund, a U.S.-based organization with offices in Kenya's Kajiado County that provides young Maasai women and girls with scholarships based on need for free education at boarding schools in Kenya. It was founded in 1999 by Barbara Shaw, an American who believed that educating girls will empower them, their families, and their communities, and lift them out of poverty.
MGF Barbara Song.
Yeah.
Shaw died in 2013, but her daughter, Tracy Piles, is continuing her mother's work.
It started with two little girls that she first met while on a photography project in Kajiado district of Kenya and staying among the Maasai in their village.
The number of girls helped by the organization has now grown to more than 150. Gloria is the first to go to medical school and train at Suburban Hospital, where Piles works as an emergency physician.
Someone like this, who has the heart that Gloria has and the desire to go back to her home, and make a difference, needs, in my opinion, to be invested in, supported, given every opportunity to make the most, because what she has the chance to do when she goes home is incredible.
The organization has proved that girls who go to school are less likely to be forced into early marriage and other cultural practices.
We have rescued girls as young as 9 who were already married. Also from FGM, or female genital mutilation, which is still something that is practiced among the Maasai.
These young Maasai are among the girls who've been rescued from early marriages and are attending school. And thanks to the organization's community programs, attitudes towards young Maasai women are also changing, especially by fathers.
It's only as these girls come back educated, teachers, doctors, lawyers, that's when they're coming to see the value of educating their daughters.
A good example is Lucy Anteya, a graduate of the program who's now its Kajiado office director.
This new generation of Maasai girls who are now getting an education, they are now showing their community that they are bringing a lot of empowerment, and they are showing the community that it is not just about a one-time dowry, but they can do a lot for themselves and for their families and for the country.
It's hard to overcome strong cultural beliefs and ingrained practices, but you're never going to do it by telling people that they're wrong or bad. But by demonstrating and showing people how their own lives can be better, that's the way to affect change.
Gloria Kotente Mometa is back in Kenya now, spending time with her family and friends and completing her 5th and final year of medical school at the University of Nairobi School of Medicine.
For me, being a doctor will just have remained a dream. But now it's a reality. Yeah.
Julie Tabo, VOA News.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner and scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Study after study has found that one of the best ways to jumpstart a sluggish economy is to invest in women, because when women take part in the formal economy, they pull their families and communities out of poverty. Still, many women face barriers that undermine their ability to start or expand their business. In particular, in many countries, women find it very difficult to access financial services. Too often, they cannot secure a loan, or they are charged a far higher interest rate than men. In late February, U.S. Ambassador-at-Large for Global Women's Issues, Catherine Russell, joined representatives from Kiva and the Inter-American Development Bank to launch the Women's Entrepreneurship Fund, an initiative that will help expand access to finance for women in 83 countries. When lenders respond to a woman entrepreneur's request for a loan through Kiva's online platform, the fund will match their contributions dollar for dollar. At the same time, the fund will collect data and measure how effective the initiative is in expanding women's access to finance. The data will help illustrate the financial needs and activity of women entrepreneurs around the world. The Women's Entrepreneurial Fund initiative seeks to improve the lives of women by removing limits on their ability to fully participate in the formal economy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.